TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. David Ray Griffin is the author of The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. That book was praised by historian Howard Zinn. When Griffin completed his analysis of the 9/11 Commission Report, a critique of the Keene-Zelikow Report, he became the first person to say on national TV that he found evidence that the Bush administration is complicit in 9/11. A professor of philosophy of religion and theology emeritus at Claremont School of Theology, David Ray Griffin is now comparing the Bush administration's myth of 9/11 to the huge body of facts gathered in the intervening years and finds contradictions even in the official explanations. You are about to hear the very moving and revealing question and answer section of Griffin's talk on 9/11. In his lecture, David Ray Griffin identified 9 myths. He spoke to the motives of the Bush administration, who used 9/11 to start 2 major wars and an unprecedented era of internal repression. Griffin spoke of myths woven around figures such as Muhammad Atta or Osama bin Laden, and he talked about technical issues, such as the collapse of the World Trade Center towers and Building 7. Intrigued by Griffin's description of the 3 sanctioned official but mutually exclusive theories of why the buildings collapsed the way they did, the topic came up again in the question and answer period. Here is a brief recap of Griffin's comment on the official story, followed by the rarely discussed question, who was the company that did the cleanup of the World Trade Center debris? Here is David Ray Griffin.
I now turn to myth number 8. Official reports have explained why the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapsed. This claim suffers from the same problem as the previous one. We have had 3 official explanations, each of which contradicts the other, and none of which is anywhere near close to adequate. The first explanation, widely disseminated through television specials, was that the buildings collapsed because their steel columns were melted by the jet fuel-fed fires. But this explanation contained many problems, the most obvious of which is that steel does not begin to melt until about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, while open fires based on hydrocarbons such as kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, cannot, even under the most ideal circumstances, rise above 1,700 degrees. A second explanation, endorsed by the 9/11 Commission report, is a pancake theory, according to which the fires, while not melting the steel, heated it up sufficiently to cause the floors weakened by the airplane strikes to break loose from the steel columns, both those in the core and those around the outside. All the floors above the strike zone hence fell down on the floor below the strike zone, causing it to break free, and this started a chain reaction so that the floors pancaked all the way down. But this explanation also suffered from many problems, the most obvious of which was that it could not explain why the buildings collapsed into a pile of rubble only a few stories high. The core of each of the twin towers consisted of 47 massive steel columns. If the floors had broken loose from them, these columns would have still been sticking up into the air 1,000 feet. The 9/11 Commission report tried to cover up this problem by claiming that the core of each tower consisted of a hollow steel shaft. But those massive steel columns could not be wished away. The definitive explanation was supposed to be a third one, issued by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, usually called NIST. The NIST report claimed that when the floors collapsed, they, rather than breaking free from the columns, pulled on them, causing the perimeter columns to become unstable. This instability then increased the gravity load on the core columns, which had been weakened by tremendously hot fires in the core, which NIST claims reached over 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, and this combination of factors resulted in global collapse. But as physicists Jim Hoffman and Stephen Jones have shown, this account is riddled with problems. One of these is that NIST's claim about the tremendously hot fires in the core is completely unsupported by the evidence or logic. A second problem is that even if this sequence of events had occurred, NIST provided no explanation as to why it would have produced global, that is, total collapse. Total collapses of steel frame high-rise buildings have never, either before or after 9/11, been brought about by fire alone or fire plus externally caused structural damage. The collapse of Building 7 has been recognized as especially difficult to explain. It was not hit by a plane, so the explanation has to rely solely on fire. And yet, because there was no jet fuel to get a big fire started, this building had fires on only two or three floors, according to several witnesses and all photographic evidence. FEMA admitted that the best theory it could come up with for this collapse had only a low probability of occurrence. The 9/11 Commission report implicitly admitted that it could not explain the collapse of this building by not even mentioning it.
That was a brief recap of the conflicts in the official theory by David Ray Griffin. He is Alan Michon, the owner of the Grand Lake Theater, where Griffin spoke in March 2006.
There are only a few demolition companies that could have pulled off a controlled demolition of the towers. Have they been investigated and individual workers sought out who might have been involved in the packing or placing of the explosives beforehand?
Of course not. Controlled demolition, that company, which is one of the few companies in the world authorized to do controlled implosions, was brought in to do the cleanup for the World Trade Center. I understand made quite a tidy profit on it. Tidy, not tiny. It's very interesting. Mark Loiseau, the president, did an interview recently in New Scientist magazine, and some very damning stuff in there inadvertently. He explains that to make a building come down in that way, straight down so no other buildings are destroyed, you know, except maybe four other buildings of the World Trade Center complex that you want to get rid of the whole thing anyway. It takes enormous planning. He says he spends, you know, hundreds of hours when it's a big building scoping it out, taking pictures, going back again. He says the explosives have to be placed just right and in precisely the right order in order to bring the building straight down. But then he says, oh, but of course the World Trade Center buildings were brought down by fire.
We have some great questions, and I know that there's going to be lots more coming up here. I will start with this one. How do you account for the fact that there are so many holes in the official story? Surely they would have planned the cover story while planning the attack. Do they want us to uncover the truth for some other reason?
That's a good question, and I devoted quite a bit of space to it in the New Pearl Harbor because I point out there are so many things that are just so obviously problematic. But one answer is that, you know, when you look at the war in Iraq, these guys are not geniuses. Now, there is a very frightening possibility, which is, yes, indeed, they do want Americans to know and know that they know we know and that there's nothing we can do about it and that they're in control. I hope that is not the case, but it well could be. And people ask me if this stuff keeps me awake at night. That possibility does sometimes.
What do you think is the best response to the phrase conspiracy theory?
Well, the quickest one is that the government's theory was the original conspiracy theory about 9/11. And it's very interesting that both President Bush and Philip Zelikow used the identical words, telling people, do not fall for outrageous conspiracy theories. But it's interesting to think about, what would be an outrageous conspiracy theory. It can't just be any conspiracy theory, since the government's theory is a conspiracy theory, according to which 19 Arab Muslims, under the inspiration of Osama bin Laden, conspired to do all these things. So what's an outrageous one? Well, if you think about these things in terms of the philosophy of science, you have good theories and bad theories. There's nothing wrong with a theory. Quantum theory is considered rather respectable, and yet it's a theory. So, and there's nothing wrong with conspiracy theories. We all believe hundreds of conspiracy theories. Every day you read the newspaper, read about, it's just when two or three people conspire in secret to do something immoral or illegal, that's a conspiracy. And so our newspapers are full of those, from robbing the local 7-Eleven to Enron conspiring to cheat its investors. So there must be something that makes something an outrageous conspiracy theory. Well, in the philosophy of science, let's start with a good theory. A good theory is one that can take account of all the relevant facts in a self-consistent way. A bad theory is one that is inconsistent with some of the relevant facts. An outrageous theory would be one that is inconsistent with all the relevant facts, and that's the official theory about 9/11.
Is there any hope of getting these issues adequately addressed by the mainstream media?
Is anybody here from the mainstream media tonight who can speak to that? There was recently a report that there was to be a discussion, I believe a film and a discussion in Japan, Tokyo, I believe, and that the bureau chief for one of our major newspapers said that if he went to that meeting, he would be fired. I suspect this is true. At least you are strongly discouraged from even attending such sessions to give them any credence whatsoever, any credibility, and certainly not to give a favorable report about them. Now, it does seem like things may be changing. For example, I know my own life the best, so I'll give a few examples. I did appear on C-SPAN a year ago, hooray for C-SPAN. Now, C-SPAN is not quite the mainstream media, but it's close. It has national coverage. So that was an important event. Then LA Times Magazine did a favorable interview with me. Another major newspaper, a major reporter for that newspaper, has done an interview with me. The photographer was even sent, and I'm told that's a surefire sign the story's going to run, because they never waste money on the photographer unless it's going to run. It has not run. That was several months ago, but Rita and Katrina and lots of other things intervened. This reporter tells me he is still going to do the story. It could happen, and this could be a big event. So I am more hopeful than I was 6 months ago, and partly because I think our corporate owners of the media may be getting more and more convinced that what this administration is doing is not good, even for corporate America, just as it appears that the elite in the country decided at a certain point that it was time for Nixon to go, and that's when the Watergate investigation was allowed to go forward. It may be that we're to the point where The wise men, now the wise men and women, will say they've got to go, and maybe 9/11's the best way to bring them down.
What about the flight that crashed in Pennsylvania? Several of my family members work for the NSA, and they say it was shot down.
I devoted quite a bit of time to it, both in the New Pearl Harbor and in the second book. And it certainly does appear that the U.S. military shot it down. I mean, there's an enormous amount of evidence that it did. And it appears that one of the motives for lying about when Cheney went down below is to make it appear that he could have not possibly given the shoot-down order. That is, everybody knows it was Cheney who gave the shoot-down order. Now, there's been the controversy, did he get the permission from the president? And, of course, they say he did, and even the 9/11 Commission expressed skepticism about that. But that aside, everybody knows that Cheney gave the order. So then the question is, when did he give the order? Every story prior to the 9/11 Commission report said that he gave it several minutes before 10 o'clock. Flight 93 was shot down at 10:03, according to the government's theory, a little later, according to seismic records, or apparently. I mean, it's a difficult question. Richard Clark, for example, had said in his book, Against All Enemies, that he was amazed when he asked for shoot-down authorization, how quickly it came from Cheney. And Clark gives the impression it came about 9:45. And he says definitely before the president's plane took off at 9:50. And then we have reports that jets were sent by the head of NEADS, NORAD's in the northeast section, and told to shoot the flight down. We have a pilot who said he heard a rumor from his other people in the military that the military had shot down an aircraft. People at the site gave all sorts of evidence that would suggest the plane had been downed probably by a missile and so on. But the 9/11 Commission said that Cheney didn't get down to the underground bunker until almost 10 o'clock. And then by the time he gave the shoot-down authorization, it was after 10:10, so that at least 7 minutes had gone by after the flight had already crashed. So the logic is that the military could not possibly have shot it down. But this is one of the most obvious lies in the commission report. Everything, including Cheney himself, indicated that he was down there long before that. And it's just amazing, or it ought to be amazing, that our mainstream press won't even point out that most obvious lie in the commission's report. Of course, another question is, if the military shot the plane down, why are they lying about it and saying they didn't? Why didn't they claim? Well, here, when we got a sufficient notification, we did our job. So see, we were trying to protect Washington. This is one of the big mysteries, why they didn't take credit for it and lied about it. One other thing happened recently, by the way. There was an envoy to Canada and talking to the Canadians about supporting America with regard to going all the way with the new plans for NORAD. And this speaker, to try to instill pride in the Canadians, said, well, you know, it was a Canadian who gave the order to shoot down Flight 93 on September 11th. Flight 93. So little bits of the truth do come out here and there, it appears.
If you believe that 9/11 is fixed, what do you see Bush doing in October 06?
I take it the suggestion is we may have another massive terrorist attack. And certainly there has been a lot of discussion of that, perhaps as a pretext to attack Iran, perhaps as a pretext to institute martial law. And I must admit, this does worry me because I'm not sure that there is anything these guys wouldn't do to stay in power and to keep the lid on things. But if I could offer one correction here, I don't think it's what Bush will do. I did mention who I think calls the shots in the White House.
Why have none of the four or possibly eight black boxes on the hijacked planes been revealed to the public?
I think that was a rhetorical question, so we can probably just move on. These black boxes could just reveal all sorts of things that contradict the official story. So we're not going to see these black boxes any more than we're going to see the videos from the Pentagon.
Why is a theologian one of the primary speakers for this cause? Do you see any religious or spiritual implications for 9/11, and what are they?
Why is a theologian speaking about this? I didn't have anything else to do. What we theologians are supposed to be doing is trying to imagine and speak about the world from the divine point of view. And if the religions of the world are basically correct, the divine is the creator and lover of all peoples, in fact, all creatures, and cares about the good of the world, the long-term good of the world, and wouldn't want people producing nuclear wars that would decimate all life on the planet, wouldn't want the global warming to continue after 30 years after we've known about it, 35 years now, about the ecological crisis, wouldn't want all these things. So I'm convinced that this administration, as was said earlier tonight, is the most dangerous administration we have ever had for the future of this country. And the future of the world. And if trying to save God's planet is not a religious issue, I wouldn't know what was. Thank you for the question.
Let me know how many more you want to do.
Let's try three.
I agree with all you said. What do we do now? A, plan a revolution. B, nonviolent resistance like Gandhi. C, move to another country. They have the president, Congress, courts, military, CIA, NSA, Homeland Security, industry, media, etc. We have what?
Well, we have each other and we have the truth, for starters. And of the three options, I would say A and B, both of them, plan the revolution and nonviolent resistance. I gave a talk recently in Santa Barbara, which was actually the first talk I gave specifically as a Christian theologian speaking on this issue to fellow Christians. And in that talk, as well as in the book I mentioned that is coming out on 9/11 and Christian faith, I suggest that what we need within the Christian church in this country is an anti-imperial movement. Something like in Germany, a year after Hitler took power, there was a movement known as the German church, the German Christians, which supported Hitler and thought he was their man who was going to bring him the kind of greatness Germany deserved. But another movement called Confessing Christians started with theologians such as Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And they argued that supporting Nazism is inconsistent with Christian faith. And so that even though on most political issues, Christians should have the freedom to believe and say what they want, on this issue, this should be made a matter of faith. And so this was an important movement. Of course, it didn't succeed. Bonhoeffer ended up dying for the cause. In South Africa, some of the churches decided that South African apartheid was so despicable, so contrary to Christian faith, that Christians had to call it a confessing situation, so that to be a Christian meant to oppose apartheid. So I believe that we are to that point in this country, and now tonight I would expand that and say that Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, ethical humanists, human beings should form an anti-imperial movement, because that's what, as I tried to make clear, 9/11 was all about, a means to increase the empire. And so we do need a revolution, a nonviolent revolution, against American imperialism before it's too late.
That was David Ray Griffin, Professor of Philosophy of Religion and Theology, Emeritus, at Claremont School of Theology. He's working on a new book entitled Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, A Call to Reflection and Action. You heard the question and answer section of a talk on 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. David Ray Griffin spoke to an overflow audience on March 30th, 2006, in Oakland, California. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for links to 9/11 sites. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.